Welcome to the Florida Specifier Podcast. This is Brett Cyphers, and I'm joined today by my co-hosts and fellow members of the Specifier Editorial Board. First, there's our editor-in-chief, Patrick Gillespie, who's an advisor with Adams and Reese. Then there's Jeff Littlejohn. He's with the National Stormwater Trust, On-Site Performance, and he's also a senior advisor at the Adams and Reese Law Firm. There's Ryan Matt. Oh, I'm sorry. Ryan is truant yet again. Busy being busy somewhere, but he is a government affairs expert with the Gray Robinson Law Firm, and we miss him today. And I'm the Government and External Affairs Director for CN Shoreline, and I host another Specifier Media podcast called Water for Fighting. Gentlemen, it's great to be here with you in the Specifier Media studio.
Yes, it is indeed.
Good to see you, too.
So, how are we doing in the end of session period here?
Well, I had a week to kind of decompress. So today I'm saying I'm doing great. I think a week ago or so, I was probably still a little strung out, a little tired, a little ready for it to end.
It's kind of a weird time, right? Like we're in this limbo where we're kind of waiting to see what's going to happen. Special sessions, budget, obviously nothing until probably mid-April, it seems, at the earliest. And then we're waiting on the Supreme Court on redistricting. So as far as what kind of activity is going to be happening over the next couple months, we're sort of just in this weird spot right now.
I mean, it's got to be, at least it is for me. And you know, I also have, you know, business that takes me out of Florida, which is kind of an interesting thing to come back and like, oh, that's right. This is, we're still doing it. But you know, other than the personal related excitement for you, you know, Patrick, is it odd? Are you still kind of a little bit on edge, or do you just kind of, you know, let it ride and, you know, when they start again, they start again?
Yeah, I think for at least most of the folks that I've been talking to, we're just waiting to see what happens. There's not a whole lot you can do until you know what the dates are. And obviously, you know, the legislature's still got to figure out where they're going to land on allocations and everything else on budget. So until that point, we're just sort of waiting to see when they come back and go from there.
Yeah, I guess that's a good segue into that, you know, that calendar, Patrick and Jeff. In terms of when they are going to start again, when we look at the close of the regular session as it stood, the budget was still pretty far apart with no real sign of closing that gap. And so, I mean, the things that I hear, maybe similar to what you hear, which is like this could go as long as it goes. Last year, they extended all the way into June to get a budget done, and they could very well do the same thing again, of course, in the midst of another special session regarding redistricting, right?
Yeah, I think the last number was about $1.5 billion difference between the two sides, which is a lot. At the same time, it's 1-something% of the total budget, so it's, you know, probably doable from that perspective. But again, I think it's just a lot of the carryover from last year, a lot of the tension between the two chambers, and, you know, they're going to have to figure out how to get it into a better spot to land the plane. You know, on the flip side, or on the other side, you've got agencies that are just sort of waiting to figure out how to plan for the next year. Then they've got to close out the current fiscal year, prep for the next fiscal year, and then, you know, oh, by the way, your LBRs are going to be due in August or September. So just a lot going on that could affect government operations.
Yeah, I think when you talk about the things that we do for a living, you know, a lot of it, you know, touches on DEP, fish and wildlife, agriculture. There are a lot of things that are going on, grant programs that really begin to tee up around this time of year. Mm-hmm. I mean, the spring is when you're getting ready to, you know, deal with things in the summer and fall. And now it's tough on those folks that are over there, the Angela Connects of the world, that are trying to figure out how do I plan with staff to deal with that influx when your time period is compressed, with also those the other duties that you were talking about, which is coming up with a whole new, you know, budget for next year. And so the challenges seem pretty steep, but I guess there's not much you can do about it. I mean, there are folks that, you know, done it for, you know, decades, and, you know, stand back up again, take the punches, and keep going.
Yeah. I think for those who are interested in stats, 237 bills were enrolled this year. It was 269 last year, so a little bit down. As of this recording, 8 have been signed by the governor. So things are kind of trickling along when it comes to bill signings and getting those things moving.
Yeah, I mean, and again, Zai, thanks for creating a perfect segue into kind of the policy end of the legislative session, because one of those bills is something that a lot of folks, certainly you know, myself, were watching, and that has to do with the nature-based solutions for resiliency. And also tucked into it was a rather interesting point of contention during session. You guys want to talk about that a bit?
Sure. I mean, I heard, you know, when the story started to hit the paper about the potential port near the Terra Ciega Aquatic Preserve in the Rattlesnake Key area, and I thought, uh-oh, this is going to be interesting. And sure enough, it, you know, got a lot of attention and quickly became an issue in the legislature. And, you know, it's pretty clear that it you know, became an issue for the members that serve those areas. They were hearing a lot of, you know, concerns from constituents. And so next thing you know, kind of late in the session, you see an amendment on the nature-based solutions bill to say, hey, guess what? No new ports within a certain distance of the Terra Ciega Aquatic Preserve. I know what that's all about. So, yeah, there was a lot of push to slow or stop that project. And I think even the governor mentioned at the signing ceremony, mentioned that we already have three ports and, you know, maybe that's enough for Tampa Bay. Yeah, it was a interesting little twist at the end.
Any bill can be a vessel, so yeah, to speak.
For sure. Nice. Even 848, yeah. Stormwater Treatment Bill, had a little anti-Rattlesnake Key potential port provision added to it near the end.
Hmm. Did that make it into the final version of 848?
It did indeed.
Can you talk about that a little bit? And I know that you're, you know, kind of close to the subject. Well, kind of close. Very close to the subject. And, you know, we obviously all know the folks and the issues involved there. Can you talk about not necessarily the conflict of it and the push and pull of the legislative session, how you grind out that sausage, but can you talk about the end result of 848 and what that means?
Sure. Yeah, I think it landed in a very good place. The new stormwater rule really dials up the requirements on every type of development, public and private, in Florida, and those new nutrient reducing requirements are going to cost more money. And having more tools in the toolbox to help offset the impacts of those increased requirements are, you know, it's really important. And what the stormwater treatment bill does was codify in law one of the tools that had already been in the rule toolbox, the regional stormwater management system, and it accelerated the development of the or finalization of a second tool to also provide compensating treatment called the water quality enhancement area. So I think it's a good step forward. It advances a policy that we need to do better with stormwater reduction, stormwater pollution reduction, and that, you know, we're going to be really innovative in terms of how we get that done, including using offsite compensating treatment. So I'm a fan of how it came out.
That was something I noticed with not just 848, but also with 302, the nature-based solutions bill, which is it created a fast forward button on that rulemaking process you don't normally see. Normally it's you need to go make rules, and then it's kind of left a little bit open-ended, you know, in terms of what that process looks like. On both of those, it said, no, by this date, you'll be noticing, you know, the development, the final, you know, finalization of those rules.
That can kind of cut both ways sometimes. Yeah. If you don't mind what kind of rule product you get, if you want it fast, you can pick fast, good, and cheap. Fast, good, or cheap, you get two out of three. Like, it's, you ever heard that expression? I don't know if it applies directly to rulemaking, but it's certainly can be hard to get a good rule in a short amount of time. I was talking to somebody about this very topic earlier this week who's got an interest in that rulemaking. And I said, look, the sooner that good ideas get brought forward, get cobbled together, and get put in DEP's hands, the better. Because starting with a blank sheet of paper in the first, you know, public workshop is not the way to get a good rule in this short amount of time.
Let's talk about another one, a friend of the specifier and a friend to engineers everywhere, and that Representative Bill Connerly had a bill. He's been pretty exciting to watch. He's a freshman, second year of his first term, and he's here to do stuff. And he's a super smart guy. And, you know, and what he's accomplished, you know, during this session seems to be, you know, show it wasn't a fluke last year, and put it that way. And so when you look at House Bill 1019, I'm not going to try to pronounce the entire word, but PFAS bill, PFAS, depending on, you know, your Spanish or not. Can you talk about that pronunciation?
That's hilarious.
Mr. Gillespie.
Perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances.
Sure.
See what
look
I just
this,
did?
Look at this.
There
guy.
You go.
I've been practicing just for that moment. No, Rip Connolly, you know, as you mentioned, can definitely handle a complex subject, and he did a great job with this bill this year. It's the beginning of the end for the use of firefighting foams that contain these PFAS substances. And what it will do is, beginning right here, July 1, 26, it will prohibit the use of firefighting foams with PFAS in them for any kind of training or testing. And it will require even the possession of any remaining firefighting foams that have PFAS, it'll require the reporting of that to DEP. Again, right out of the gate this July. Beginning next year, there will be no more sale or distribution of PFAS-containing foams, and all remaining inventories have to be destroyed. And then the following, 2 years after July 1, 2029, firefighting facilities across the state will be prohibited from having it at all. So it gives them 2 years to kind of destroy whatever the last inventories that may exist. There are some exceptions for aviation and military, and some of those are going to be covered under federal, requirements that aren't subject to state law. So there was a carve out for that. But it's clearly a strong signal that we want to move past the PFAS foams, and I think that was a good policy. It also got a provision added to it that was a big issue for Rep. Connolly. He wanted to start getting public wastewater facilities to begin testing for PFAS in their wastewater and their biosolids.
Right.
And that raised some eyebrows. And a couple of amendments were made to that provision as it moved through the floor for what facilities are subject to that requirement raised a little bit, so it didn't capture the smallest little package plants everywhere. Mm. So it's going to impact, some of the larger facilities. Just noting that or detecting the presence of PFAS in wastewater effluent or biosolids is going to be interesting when that information is well known. I don't know. I don't like making predictions here, but I suspect maybe next year we might see a liability, relief bill for those very same facilities, because I think there may be, could be people that start to file lawsuits about concerns about risk or where is this going? And
sure.
Does it impact the environment?
It's a big issue, and it has been for a few years now. And it's not just PFAS, but other constituents in drinking water in, North Carolina, Camp Lejeune, places like that, where not just from a drinking water public health perspective, but environmental health perspective in terms of what impacts those kinds of pollutants have in the state's water bodies. I don't see that being any different. Like, that question seems to come up a lot in Florida now, which is not just that simple, how do you mitigate to make sure you're not drinking it, but it's, what is it doing when it's in these water bodies and you get those mm-hmm. secondary introductions. Let's talk about one that didn't make it across the finish line. It looked like it was close, but it's a old tale with some new words to it, and that was House Bill 981, and that's the old Ocklawaha River Rodman Dam dance that it seems like legislators and others, environmental groups, local fishing groups, other interested parties have been doing this, since they built it almost, it seems like, when they were doing the Cross Florida Barge Canal, which was, the 50s? I mean, it wasn't that long ago that it was built, and nearly immediately it was a point of contention for a lot of folks. What do y'all think about that?
Well, certainly, I wasn't following this in terms of having insider information, but just kind of following it from afar, it was interesting to see that there's a lot of pushback locally from folks saying this wasn't something we were asking for, this is not something that we're wanting. Right around the time all that kind of chatter came out is around the time that it sort of died in committee, and so we all probably had different parts and pieces being impacted by this issue over the years given our time at DEP, but it's one of these things that's always been around and has always been an issue, and mm-hmm. it's always been something that has been thought about, and this year someone tried to do something about it, and then obviously didn't work out in the end. But
it happens. It gets varying degrees of close. This seems to be the closest because it passed almost every committee without objection, and then you get right down to the end, you know, and in the Senate just kind of faded away, you know, in these last moments, as a lot of bills do. I mean, with that, you know, when you have controversies or wording that someone doesn't like, they just kind of find a way to die in rules or die on the floor. I had the opportunity to meet Margaret Spontak. I actually recorded a Water for Fighting podcast with her recently. Very interesting woman. Brother used to work at the St. John's River Water Management District. I knew him a little bit back in the early days when I was working for Jeb, but she's executive director of the Great Florida Riverway Trust, and they want to do the restoration of the Ocklawaha. And so it was on that kind of pro mm-hmm. side there. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like, you know, with Duggan and Broder that, you know, it had its best chance because mm-hmm. those are two really good members to move something forward. But, you know, the complications of these things, I think, are just one where when you're going to impact, you know, folks' lives or change, mm-hmm. you know, potentially livelihoods, you can run into a brick wall there. So sure. I'm curious to see what happens with it in the future. But at least for now, I think it's clearly, you know, again, in the dustbin.
I think we're going to have to wait till that thing just collapses. I mean, I don't know. Politically, it yeah. just seems like it's the Hatfields and McCoys. Like, I don't know how you get the two groups to agree on something so fundamentally disagreeable. So divided about that.
I remember.
It may eventually just fall apart because yeah. I'm not sure anybody's maintaining it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure who owns it. It used to be owned by the Corps of Engineers.
The Corps, yeah.
I mm-hmm. think they walked away from it. Does the state own it? Does anybody even know?
Water Management District?
I don't know.
I don't know.
No, I do believe that it is. I think it is owned by the state because in terms of the permitting and maintenance part of it, that I think they're not. I don't know for sure that that's the case.
I think in 2011, when I got the first briefing on this issue at DEP, and I, like, what? You mean this was a federal project, and they just walked off and handed the keys to the state, and we,
yeah,
took them.
We've got it now, and we took them first. We took it. We didn't just chuck it back.
I mean, there are things like that. I think if folks out there knew how many of those little instances happen when you talk about, like, WikiWatchy is a, you know, a good example of, you know, turning mermaids into state employees, or even here, the Talquin Dam used to be a hydroelectric dam that went defunct, and then somebody came in and decided they didn't want it, and so everyone just kind of abandoned it, and so then it belongs to the state. Now you have this high hazard dam, you know, that is now the responsibility of the state. And I think by, you know, there was some thought that even the Water Management District up here might be end up responsible for that. I have my own opinions there that I'll keep to myself for general comedy. But yeah, there are things like that all over. I remember I was working at Swift Mud. Yet another case of Crooked, Reedy, and Clinch Lakes, and you had dams between. And they said the old days, when they were arguing over it, somebody would just dynamite the dams. And so,
good way to fix it, right?
Late 19th problem century. Solved. Yeah, solving problems.
Fire in the hole.
The old-fashioned way.
Well, there's one more bill that I was kind of tracking that was just personally interesting, which was the data center bill. Mm. So this is a big kind of politically controversial issue with some environmental energy impacts, but kind of the debate over whether Florida wants to be a place that houses data centers and gets into that business is interesting politically, given some of the commentary from the current governor and gubernatorial candidates. But then you've got the environmental issue of water use and energy use, and how does that going to impact ratepayers and all those things. So that was an interesting one that went all the way down to the last week, back and forth. Things were being kicked back and forth and ultimately passed. And it's going to be interesting to see whether the governor signs it or not, because that's an issue that he's been very vocal about.
No, that's a good one, interesting one. And again, it's like when Rep Connerly's involved, he's got a ton of ideas in terms of what the future looks like in terms of that kind of power production without the, I think, with a less of a reliance on the water it takes to feed and cool these places. So very, very interesting to see how that ends up, because I don't think, you know, people are going to stop using their chat GPTs and so forth for the foreseeable future.
Given the number of AI-driven images on the internet, right. I don't think that is going away anytime soon.
Yeah, who doesn't love a good cat with a machine gun in his hands?
Is that what you use chat GPT for?
I mean, that's what most of the videos seem to be.
A lot of people seem to be doing stuff like that.
But just
must be your algorithm
moving the human race forward, or something. You want to talk about the paper, Patrick?
yeah, that's why I'm here. So we put an editor's note in there about Session, obviously with the budget not finished, and given our production timelines, we weren't able to get a lot of legislative content into the paper. We did have a pretty extensive article on a lot of the policy ideas that had been filed that potentially affect wildlife, so there is an article on that, so we did get that coverage. But we will be updating FloridaSpecifier.com with updates as bills are signed and once we have some bill action, so please check that out to stay up to date on what's passing or what's passed and what's being signed. Theme-wise, there really wasn't a consistent theme, just really trying to put in place a lot of the updates on things that have happened in the past that we've covered before, and just make sure that our readers are aware of just all kinds of interesting policy issues going on around the state and around the region, and a good blend of interesting projects and just kind of interesting topics, I think, that are going around the state. And I'll just make a pitch for those listening. Mid-April, April 13th week is going to be our deadline for our next edition. So if you have ideas, something that you want to bring forward as a story idea, please reach out. It's patrick@floridaspecifier.com. Shoot me an email and we'd love to chat with you about it.
Yeah, and offering his services, because even if you have an idea, Patrick loves to write. And so even if you're trying to formulate something and you think you can't write, I'm one of those people, which is how to start an article. Touch base with him. I think you might find that he can help you pull something together.
Thanks, Brett.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Is it my turn to ask everybody what their favorite articles are?
Yeah, hey.
That's what the paper says.
I told you you're going to have to do some talking.
Okay. Well,
I guess we do miss Ryan. I don't know.
Yeah, he's, yeah.
While you're talking about the paper, Patrick, do you have any favorite articles?
Oh, thanks for asking, Jeff. I actually really enjoyed, and I wrote this one, about the wood stork. So this was kind of Jeff and I talked about this a little bit.
Story.
I guess it is a success story.
So I love it when species come off the endangered species list.
Well, everyone loves that. Everyone loves that, right? Well, what made it interesting is the citation from U.S. Fish and Wildlife was climate change. So essentially what they said in their rule is that because of climate change and different habitats and how those have changed, the wood stork now has more habitat available. So as water nice. Patterns have changed and that's affected land, they now have more ability to breed and live. And so obviously that's a little bit newsworthy given the narrative around climate change that's been building for the last couple decades. And so just thought that was a really interesting take on something that impacts Florida as well.
So you want to get a I Heart Wood Storks bumper sticker for all your gas guzzling cars out there? You're just doing
I didn't say
doing
that.
Your thing for I just for wrote, the wood stork.
I just wrote that's an article,
right.
Man.
Okay, all right. No advocacy involved, just the facts.
I'm just a journalist. I'm not an advocate.
I understand. Good stuff. How about you, Brett? You have anything that jump out at you in this paper?
Indeed, it has. And I want to thank Brian Armstrong and Cassidy Hampton from Southwest Florida Water Management for putting out a very informative article on their passage approval of the 2025 Regional Water Supply Plan for Swift Mud. It's a place that has dealt with incredibly difficult water supply issues for 4 decades plus at this point. They've made a ton of recovery. The outlook looks really good. This is gonna sound like a really big number, but in the grand scheme of things and what they've been through over the last 30 plus years, they're looking at an additional demand of about 215 million gallons of water a day. That's a lot of water, no matter how you look at it. But through the process of this planning, this identification of projects, they create this menu of opportunities for local governments and others to have access to this water. That also includes about 50 million gallons a day of potential conservation. And so that they're that far ahead of the game and looking at these, it's not prescriptive necessarily. I mean, although there's a lot, they spend a lot of their resources trying to help people identify and get to new water sources that aren't harmful to legal existing users and wetlands and lakes and things like that. They've got a great story to tell. It's important work that they're doing in a place that's going to continue to grow very fast for years to come. And so great work, very informative. Always glad to hear that they're up and doing stuff.
One of the things I think the article said is they were projecting 8 million more people in 2040, 2045 than 2020.
That's right.
I mean, that's an incredible increase of people, and you hear it, right? You see Tampa Bay is one of the more popular places where people are sort of flocking to. And just to think about 8 million more people in that area, I mean, that's a lot of water. And their district, obviously, is not just Tampa Bay. It goes all the way down to Sarasota, mm-hmm. up to, I think, Levy or Marion County. So it's a huge area, but yeah. that's still a lot of people. And then that's more businesses, and that's more, you know, it's just the demand isn't really crushing.
And a lot of times they're limited in terms of what they have access to. You have coastal counties, which you have to get to the water without saltwater intrusion into right. your drinking wells. You have waterlocked places like Pinellas County, where you have to figure out how to create enough water for them without, you know, wrecking, you know, back in the old days, the way it was, where, sinkholes and wetlands and lakes dried up in Pasco County and I think even South Hernando because just trying to get, match up with that growth. And I think the way they go about it now, I think they have, great staff, work really well with these communities, have a lot of history doing it and solving problems. And so a lot more confidence in it now than I think people did 20, 25 years ago.
What about you, Jeff? You know, any favorites you want to chat about?
I'm a huge fan of Danielle Irwin. She's a colleague of ours.
Gal.
Yeah, great lady and a fellow DEP alum, served with us when we were DEP. And she, in a story that I think should warm a journalist's heart, Patrick, she called me. We were talking about living shorelines permitting and, some frustration she was having. And I said, Danielle, you should write an article. Next thing you know, Patrick's got the thing in his hands and is editing this thing. So anyway, I just enjoyed talking to Danielle about living shorelines permitting. It is complicated. I think it clearly should be improved. The other thing I like about this, given SB 702 passing, is I think it may very well be a playbook for some of the improvements we need to see in the rulemaking when DEP gets to the nature-based solutions rulemaking. I think there's some things in this article that I think would be a great placeholder or starting point to help improve the rulemaking. So kudos to Danielle. Thanks for bringing this issue to our attention, and hope this is a way to encourage other people to call us and reach out. And, we love advancing good policy. We love identifying issues, opportunities to improve. And I think this is a good example of that.
Yeah. Well, and we all know the regulatory permitting process is so complex. There's so many things you have to consider, regardless of what the agency is. But when you're on the environmental side, there's just so much to it. And at the same time, there's a lot of people out there that want to make a lot of companies and a lot of cities and a lot of projects out there that need to move forward. And so it's in staffing challenges. I mean, there's, we know all the excuses for it, but I think the way Danielle articulated some of the challenges and some of the frustrations, maybe it'll spur some action or some conversations. But to Jeff's point, the fact that there's legislation moving as well might be a good sign to get some of this cleared up and streamlined.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. She framed the issue really well. And it is interesting, from a public policy standpoint, and I think that they recognize this now in the legislature, the idea that restoration project would be more arduous in terms of dealing with the permitting hurdles involved than a non-protective, say like a
seawall. You don't want a seawall to be easier to permit than a living shoreline, right? If you're advocating for
right.
for these types of projects, these restoration forward projects, but they can be more complicated because of the accretion and the sovereign lands issues that Danielle raised.
Well, let's move on to some podcasts. There's some interesting things going on, I think, on both sides. One, if you're an OG Marco Islander talking about summer school, you'll be getting a call, if you haven't already, from Jamie Sheehan or Megan Holly about doing a recording with Ryan and myself to talk about some of those early days. We're in the 40th annual summer school coming up in July, and so we want to capture some of that leading up to when we get down there, so people can kind of hear those and reminisce. And those of us who are relative newcomers at 23, 24 years ago would get a chance to kind of hear how these things start and some of those early folks. And you're going to recognize a lot of those names. So we look forward to talking to a whole bunch of folks leading up to that. If you want to do a podcast and you're just interested in things that you're doing, Danielle, you are on my list. By the way, this article is a really good one that you did, and I'm looking forward to trying to chase you down to talk with me. And that kind of moves us to the Water for Fighting episodes. As I said before, I recorded an episode with Margaret Spontak regarding the Ocklawaha and her life in general, but I also have some coming up and we'll have the COO of my company, CN Shoreline, Andy Reese. A very interesting guy, looking forward to sitting down and really learning more about him. We're going to have Herschel Vineyard, former Secretary of DEP. Yeah, he's okay.
I can't wait to hear that one.
Yeah. Former board member.
I want to know if he wears a seersucker for the interview.
I think I have to require it, don't I?
You should definitely get a picture so you could post
it. It's audio. No, yeah. It doesn't really matter.
But if you get a picture, maybe a little video, it's worth it. All right. Tell him it's on camera. He'll wear a seersucker.
But it's a great lineup. Chuck Drake, he's old school Tetra Tech, and he's also a former board member of the St. John's River Water Management District. Wonderful guy. I've known him for the entire time that I've been in state government. Had some wonderful conversations way back when. We've got author Cindy Littlejohn is going to come in. We're going to talk about her book and her life a little bit. Justin Friedman from Res, he's the general manager in Florida and former Liverpool Football Club fan like myself. So I'm looking forward to spending some time with him. And as of today, I got Mary Ellen Winkler locked in. She's going to come in. She's the assistant ED from St. John's River Water Management District, which makes it a pretty St. John's River area-centric slate of podcasts for the season, but looking forward to it.
So we have some events coming up just to make sure everybody's aware. Obviously, we publish our conferences and events section, so there's a couple in there wanted to mention, just get on everybody's radar. The Florida Association of Environmental Professionals, their annual conference, late April, early May in Stuart. So definitely check that out. Speaking of PFAS, I'm going to stick to PFAS because I can't say it like Jeff can. A PFAS forum is going to be at the Rosen in Orlando, May 13 to 15. So that obviously, given legislation and all the topics, that'll be a good one to keep your eyes on. And then the Florida Recycle Conference is going to be June 22 and 24 in Daytona Beach Shores. So have a lot of fun talking about recycling.
This isn't a knock on the PFAS forum, but the idea that they use Latin numerals, or Roman numerals rather, same difference, to show which one it is pretty exciting for me, which gets me closer going.
That's what puts you over the top? All right.
I think that about covers it. Thanks for listening to the Florida Specifier Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to hit subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen, and don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. But if you don't like what you hear, it is definitely Ryan Matthews' fault, so do be sure to let him know, and don't hold it against the rest of us. I recommend subscribing to the Florida Specifier online at floridaspecifier.com, and read your environmental news and commentary the new old-fashioned way. But please do be sure to subscribe. It's easy, inexpensive, and offers a ton of ways to read, watch, listen, and learn at your fingertips. Your support is greatly appreciated.
Production of this podcast is by Carl Sorn and David Barfield at Lonely Fox Studios. And we want to thank Bagels and Biscuits for letting us use their music for the podcast. Join us next time as we delve into the issues, policy, and people that environmental professionals and policymakers want to know. For Jeff Littlejohn, Brett Cyphers, I guess, and Ryan Matthews, I'm Patrick Gillespie, and we'll see you next time.